This is Radio Freethinker, episode 71.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Yes, Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking. And my name is Ethan, your free thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
This is Rob, cognitive psychologist and beachgoer.
So, gentlemen, how was your weekend?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm a beachgoer. Actually, I was going with some friends to the beach yesterday, but the weather forecast turned out to be cloudy with a chance of rain, so we went in entirely the opposite direction and ended up in Whistler.
Interesting. How about you, Don?
My week was pretty good up until 2 days ago, where I lost yet another hard drive. I don't know what it is. I've had good luck with hard drives my entire life, but in the last 6 months, I've lost three or four hard drives, and I don't mean lost as in it's in the couch somewhere. I mean explosions, fire, death, no fire. But I went to my computer, I was listening to a song on my computer, and it suddenly stopped. And I went, that's odd. Went over to it, and my whole OS was just gone.
Do you find that when you walk underneath street lamps, they suddenly shut off?
You know, now that you think, and I haven't been able to wear a wristwatch for years.
What have you been up to this weekend?
Well, I went and got some groceries. I caught a few movies. Mm-hmm. But
and you got married in?
Well, I don't get married. I did actually happen to go to a little thing called the Amazing Meeting in Las Vegas. And I got a chance to interact with some pretty amazing people, hence the Amazing Meeting. And as everyone knows, the Amazing Meeting is put on by the James Randi Educational Foundation every year in Las Vegas. I was there, got some great interviews, met some great people, saw some great talks, awesome workshops, bought some great books, and had them signed. Yes, I do that.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was fantastic. What made it even better, though, is when I got home, I discovered in my mailbox a HST reimbursement check for my whatever it is quarterly stipend from the government, which I am going to party down with by buying groceries and essential services.
Aren't you going to pay off the debt you incurred in order to go to Las Vegas?
No, I'm not.
You gambled there, right?
No, I don't gamble.
What?
You didn't see any shows either. I was talking
before
the show.
I'm going to a skeptical conference. Gambling doesn't seem to be quite within the spirit of the event.
But you would have known, because everyone knows, right? If you look at the slot machines, right? If someone's not won on a slot machine in a while, it's due to win, right? Yeah. I mean, everybody knows that.
Yeah, it's called the gambler's fallacy or something like that. It must work every time.
Exactly. No, I the money that I didn't gamble, I spent on booze.
So, what were some of the best talks that you saw while you were there?
Well, the keynote by Richard Dawkins was really interesting. It was in the form of an interview with DJ Grothry, and who was the former host of Point of Inquiry. And DJ's questions were really, really great. He, the first thing he asked Dawkins was, what's more important to you, being identified as an atheist or being identified as a skeptic? And Dawkins replied that it's hard for him to imagine someone being a skeptic and not becoming an atheist. Which, I mean, as you guys would imagine, is a pretty contentious point in the skeptical community. There are a lot of people out there who do consider themselves skeptics and are religious. You know, Martin Gardner, for instance, was an example. Unfortunately, I missed a couple talks because I was, you know, doing interviews, but I understand that Adam Savage did a fantastic talk. And during his talk, a moon hoaxer got up and started yelling.
Moon hoaxer, as in the moon landing was a hoax filmed in the Hollywood studio somewhere?
Yeah. I wish I was there to see that, unfortunately, but I was busy interviewing people. The Phil Plait's talk was really fantastic. Actually, it was quite contentious as well. Phil basically came down hard on what we've occasionally talked about as asshole skepticism. Basically saying, I mean, the moral of his talk was don't be a dick.
And always a good moral to take home.
Basically arguing that nobody is ever going to be convinced by
a dick.
By being dickish to people, you know, telling them that they're wrong, that it's stupid to believe what they believe.
Well, you know, that's kind of a dick of him to say that.
Yeah, it was kind of... Phil Plait is really known for being a really aggressive and angry man, but no, I'm just kidding. But, you know, that itself is also a relatively contentious point. So I was pretty impressed by what they presented at TAM. It wasn't all, echo chamber.
Everyone agrees, preaching to the choir.
There was a lot of, I think, talks and workshops where people walked away saying, wow, I was really challenged there. And I think I may not agree exactly. So
self-questioning, always important.
Well, we do have an interview later on the show. In fact, one of my favorite interviews that we did in TAM, and I'm really excited to show it to all you guys, so I hope that you like it, and please write in and let us know what you think at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. But let's get to that later. Why don't we start off with some skeptical news? Rob, you were recently talking to me about infants' brains.
Yes. It turns out that they're extremely delicious for breakfast. I was reading through the usual science blogs, and this thing has been making the rounds. I found out about it on Discover, but it made it to Wired. It made it to several news outlets. Jason Hill and colleagues just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or charmingly abbreviated PNAS, they were doing some research in... infant brain development, and they were looking at, and one of the things that they were looking at was the different sections, different parts of the brain develop at different speeds and in different ways. The complexity of the brain is not regular. It develops in an irregular fashion. But one of the interesting things they found was that the way the infant brain develops mirrors the way we think the human brain evolved over time from ape-like ancestors. So they found that the prenatal brain sort of develops, and then you get the basic sort of mammalian function of vision, breathing, that sort of stuff. And only postnatally, later, the higher functions develop.
Doesn't that make some sort of, logical sense? Maybe not biological sense, but... But, you know, first you get the bones. Well, actually, no, you don't get the bones, do you? First you get something else. Okay.
You get all the fluidy, the fluid bags,
the mushy
basically,
parts.
Yeah. And, the fact that the brain develops in a way that mirrors the way the brain evolved might not be surprising if you remember from way back in your high school biology classes that the embryo develops in roughly the same way we think humans evolved. Although, if you remember the usual embryo diagram that those science textbooks used to have, that actually has some contention around it, whether it was true or manipulated or whether it's completely fake or not, that creationists like to drag out. But the fact is that embryos do develop in a way that roughly equivalents to evolution, and so this independent finding that the infant brain developed in the way that we think the brain evolved in humans is pretty cool. And they were sort of speculating on why, and they hypothesized that it's important that the basic stuff develops first, partially because it's the most important stuff for survival. You need to be able to breathe, you need to be able to see. But also, as the frontal lobe accumulates mass, the head gets bigger, and it's important for the head to fit through the birth canal. So it makes complete evolutionary sense that the stuff that makes your head bigger, i.e. the higher functioning stuff, would go postnatally, because if it happened prenatally, then that would be rather more uncomfortable for the lady giving birth than it already is.
Hmm.
And if I remember correctly, there's actually some structural reasons why the, you know, female hips move apart to a certain degree, but they've kind of reached their natural limit while being still able to support the mother. So that's like, that's a evolution would in theory say, well, why don't you just make the hips bigger? But it's done that. So I guess cesarean sections, though, should allow us to breach that breach.
Oh, dear. Oh, yeah, I just thought it was cool that this story sort of is like another independent confirmation of evolution and something really cool for the way cognition and brain develops in infants.
Actually, you know, it's funny because I had a related thing that I just remembered, sorry, guys, but about the Mozart effect, which has been going around again as being disproven. And the lady who did the original thing, you know, if you let your child listen to Mozart, it's supposed to improve their cognitive abilities. And she's been doing rounds again. I believe she's released more research in the area. And she keeps saying, oh, well, you know, they took that story and they just went way out in left field, right? All I said was, in one particular test, you got a slight improvement at one particular time, and we happened to use Mozart as our test versus meditation. And apparently her new study says, well, any music you like works.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. But the funny thing is it's doing the rounds right now. I would have thought they would have done the rounds. I think it was in January I was listening to the fact that the company that did Mozart for Your Baby, it was a company that was releasing a whole bunch of things, it was offering refunds to
anyone.
It was
Disney. Disney was doing these Baby Genius, I think, of tapes, and they were offering refunds to all the people that had bought it, possibly due to a class action lawsuit, actually.
Possibly. Which just tells you, you can't always believe what you read in newspapers.
Give me an example of this, Don.
Well, you know, my research team came up with this article. Apparently, this was an AP story in MSNBC, which is kind of the lefty one, about the Chinese justice system. And the headline reads, Chinese court sentenced drunk driver to death.
Now, that sounds a little harsh.
You know, and that's a funny, before the show, Ethan read that first line and he said, wow, that sounds really harsh. It was his first thing. And that was sort of the whole point of the article. You know, the idea is to sit there and say, you know, in the United States, we've kind of got it better. The United Chinese are so much harsher. He later on in the story makes another statement where he says, China imposes capital punishment more than any other country. Amnesty International says China puts at least over 1,700 people to death last year. The actual figures are believed to be higher. Now, based on that, you'd sit there and say, whoa. But in context, what actually happened, apparently, was this particular drunk driver was driving without a license. He slammed into another car. He killed four other people, put one in the hospital. And what he was being condemned for was killing of four other people. And even those figures, you know, China puts to death more people than any other country. Well, you may not know this, but there are a lot of people in China. About a third of the world population or a quarter of the world population live in China. So it actually works out that China is the 14th most capital punishment country in the world. Yeah, I did.
Who's number one?
The number one is Bahamas. So don't go to the Bahamas if you want to live. Followed by Singapore. And in fact, the United States, which actually this surprised me, ranked 20th. Because I always thought the United States would be up there, but they have this big thing. But
no, they just let them lounge in jail instead of killing them. And that is why most of the American population, more so than almost anyone else on the planet,
well, actually,
is in jail.
I do think the United States per capita, important context here, has more people in jail than any other country in the world. But it's also more profitable to keep them in jail than killing them. Although, depending on who you talk to. But no, I just thought this was such a perfect example of how you can take the facts and manipulate them in such a way as to make it sound, well, however you want. In this particular case, the guy was like, United States good, China bad.
Well, why don't we take a commercial break? When we come back, we'll have our first interview from Tam, and I encourage you to stay tuned. This is going to be a good one.
Hello, everybody. My name is David Dichter. I sing with MDC, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And I hope you have a great day, and kill the cop in yourself, and hopefully the rest will follow.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker at TAM, the amazing meeting in Las Vegas. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian, and I'm here with Jennifer Michael Heck, who is a poet, philosopher, historian, and skeptic. Jennifer, welcome to Radio Freethinker.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, are you enjoying TAM so far?
Yeah, it's terrific. Great bunch of people.
So, you have a very diverse resume, a poet, philosopher, historian. Which of these professions do you find leads more towards skepticism?
Well, that's an interesting question. Let's see. My PhD is in the history of science, and I think you can say that the philosophy of science is how science works, and the history of science is how science doesn't work, which is to say it's very interested in looking at the way science is a cultural product. So I would say, in that sense, the history of science is very much interested in skepticism and the history of it.
Okay. As a fellow historian, I'm very curious to hear other skeptics and their take on the field of history itself. Do you think historic research is on terms par with the way scientific research is done, that it has a method and a logical way of going about things? Or do you think history is more about interpretation than it is about logical analysis?
That's an interesting question. I think that history has had lots of different methodologies that try to approach a sort of empirical way of looking at things. The problem is, it's all people. Mm-hmm. And everyone who kept records, everybody is a person, and they all have their biases. So almost we tend to find that it's interpretive. But being interpretive doesn't necessarily mean less contact with some notion of truth. You can be interpretive and also have a way of making a pretty good case. And I think the truth is, I think that science is more like history than I think history is like science. I think science is a terrific methodology, but its conclusions tend to be historical.
Do you feel that history is then a social science? Some people classify it as a humanities. Where do you like to see history fit in?
Well, I'm not sure that social science is a term which is all that useful. I think it's part of the humanities, and I think that the best of most social science is also based in the humanities. Look, the experimental method has a lot to recommend it, but there are some things that actually hinder our vision of what's going on. For one thing, just the notion that if you ask people what look like objective questions, and you ask 100 different people for the answer, you get something that approximates a sort of mathematical truth. You do definitely find out if on a Tuesday in June I ask 100 people this question, what answer will I get? But whether or not you find out for sure what they think depends on whether your questions have all sorts of cultural hidden things in them. Even, are you happy? Mm-hmm. What's happy? And also how were you raised to think a person ought to answer that question? Is a person an idiot if they say they're not happy? And then in which case, you can be awfully unhappy without mentioning it. So there's so much that skews things, whereas historically, instead of going around and asking 100 people the same question, you had, say, one person doing the thinking with a lot of talking to other people. Then at least you have one person consistently who, at least in their own mind, means the same definition mm-hmm. by these things. So there are ways in which I feel I could almost argue that old school philosophy is more scientific, less problematically riddled with error than some of the social sciences.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about your book, Doubt a History. Mm-hmm. Very interesting book about the history of doubt. And you've mentioned in the past that you wrote it from the point of view of a history of atheism.
Yeah.
But your publishers wanted you to call it the history of doubt. Were they afraid of the atheism?
Yeah, they were afraid of the atheism. I came up with doubt, a history, but they definitely wanted it to not be a history of atheism. I brought it to them as a history of atheism. Hmm. And this was, I guess, 2001, I got the contract. And the book came out in 2003, so it's before the, you know, this brotherhood of atheists, new atheism thing that's come along. And the response has been overwhelmingly positive. I thought, especially since I was quoting people who didn't even dare use their real names, but I'm using my name quoting mm-hmm. them, I thought I would get a great deal of hate mail, and I haven't. I'm still, what is this, 7 years later, I'm still getting letters of appreciation from people saying, you know, that they're in a town where there are no other non-believers or questioners. And, the only time I get hate mail is sometimes an editor of a newspaper will encourage me to speak my mind enough so that we'll get to a place where I'll get some negative feedback. But the truth is I'm invited to churches and temples just as much as universities and atheist meetings.
Hmm.
And the churches and temples tend to be filled with people who like religion or like an aspect of religion but are profoundly questioning of God and of the tenets of their religion. So it's been an interesting ride.
You mentioned new atheism, and your book did come out before that term was quoted or invented or whatever.
Right.
Do you consider yourself a new atheist?
That's an interesting question, but I don't think I can exactly answer it. I guess I'll say no, because when a movement comes along after your book, and Christopher Hitchens took a great deal from my book in his God Is Not Great, and he does cite me more than anyone else, really, but he cites me when he borrows my quotes that, you know, took me a year of reading everything Einstein wrote, and he just lifts the quotes and then misinterprets them. A little off-putting. So I would say no. I guess I don't feel part of that group.
Okay. New atheism is often defined as sort of being confrontational, unapologetic. You mentioned that you've been invited to speak for religious groups. Is that because maybe your tone is less confrontational?
Well, yeah. I imagine that is the case. People are interested in the subject, and when they don't feel like they're being insulted, they ask for someone to come and tell them about it. The first time that I really felt like I was in no way compromising, I give talks to a lot of different people. The Mormons flew me out to Salt Lake City and then bought all my books and stuff. But there was one meeting at a large Episcopal church in Manhattan, fancy church, and instead of giving a talk, which is what I was expected, the rector of the whole cathedral asked questions, and that's when I found out when asked a direct question, I can't lie, I just tell the truth. And so I was standing in front of this group of people who were meeting as Christians. It was a Sunday morning, and I'm explaining to them both, not only do I not believe in an afterlife, but I think it's better this way. I think death really concentrates the mind. Samuel Johnson said, when you know you're going to be hung in 2 weeks, it wonderfully concentrates the mind. And I think the way that the great philosophers throughout history have dealt with death by confronting it and sort of moving through the fear of it and seeing how that then enlivens the life that we have, that kind of message, people in the pews want to hear it. They, you know, when I tell them, look, I know that at funerals, just when you need God the most, the believers, many times the believers do not believe in that moment. They're angry that anyone's telling them they're going to see their loved one again. They know they're not. But what happens is that, a few months later, they begin to feel haunted. And that feeling, the way we carry around those who have passed, that is the real and profound and extraordinary afterlife that we can give each other. And they want to hear this. They know that in the most extreme moments in their life, their faith is not fully adequate. And they seem to eat it up. They take notes. They come and ask me, you know, to repeat things. That woke me up and told me, say what I believe wherever I am. And that's what I've been doing. And I find myself met by people who really want to hear these things.
So in researching for doubt, was under the impression that doubt or atheism was sort of born out of the Enlightenment and the scientific revolution.
Yeah.
Was that what you thought, too?
To some degree. I started the project because, I had finished a PhD in history already at that point, and as I was reading, because I'm an atheist and had been since I was about 12 years old, I always noticed religious doubt, religious questioning, and atheism. And in small books, you know, what we call monographs in history, I found atheists everywhere. And as soon as I would find somebody trying to collect an overall picture, either of, you know, Germany through history or all of history, Western civilization, whatever, then the atheists disappear. And so I just thought at first, oh, I'll just be writing up what I know, this story that's there. But I did think there would be a blank part in the Middle Ages where I would be writing, okay, it was dark here, and it gets reborn a little in the Renaissance and then in the Enlightenment, as you say. And I was shocked to find it never goes away. Mm-hmm. There are doubters and outright unbelievers in Europe all through history. There is, in 1277, the Catholic Church puts out a promulgation at the University of Paris saying, you know, you can no longer say that Christian teachings lead only to ignorance. You can no longer say that man could be adequately generated by putrefaction, which was the way of saying, look, somehow things rot and become other things. Life must have generated this way. The list of things in this document of 1277 shows you that this is prime Middle Ages, and there were people who were discussing every aspect of questioning religion. And the Inquisition documents have been translated increasingly in the last 15 years. And what we're seeing is it's not all heretics, people who were being punished for believing something different than the church believed. There's a lot of people being punished for not believing anything at all. Some of them with scholarly knowledge of Greek and Roman atheism, and some of them just because their whole family died of the plague, and they know that there's something immoral about that. This universe is not moral. They know they would never do that to someone else. Mm-hmm. So they say, from that, I extrapolate that there is no just God, and if there's no just God, probably isn't one at all. And they all are trying to save their necks. They're not stupid, but they get pushed. They get goaded in just the way you or I would eventually perhaps blurt out, this is nonsense.
Right.
And that's what happens.
So you mentioned the plague. Are there any factors that you've noticed maybe that occur in a logical or predictable basis that actually encourage atheism or doubt in societies?
Yeah, absolutely. Cosmopolitanism. The mixing of peoples and beliefs immediately stirs up uncertainty. If my holy day is different from your holy day, I'm at least going to ask a few questions about, you know, what's holy about these days, and where did these facts come from? And that's what's happened. So through trade, war, migration, natural disaster, whenever we see areas begin to be more cosmopolitan, we see their literature get very fractured and anxious, because it's scarier. Mm-hmm. If you just live in Athens, at the height of Athens, you have the Athens gods, and you have the Athens culture, and you can have a feeling of living for the polis, for the future of this group, which seems to keep you kind of content within the mythos of that group. Well, once these groups get mixed up, it's disturbing, but there also tends to be a rise of the middle class, a rise of general wealth, a rise of general health, and a great rise of skepticism. I'll just add one more thing that we find over and over through history, that the leading skeptics are children of the clergy in all different communities, because the children of the clergy got the best education. And so they actually were able to make some sense of these things. So we see that flip a lot.
Is there a requirement that a society have a tolerance for free thinking, or can doubt flourish in a repressive environment as well?
Good question. I think it can flourish in a repressive environment. I think also there are times when we see it just plain gets squashed so that you can't find it anymore. But for the most part, I think people would be surprised. I found so much doubt in Golden Age Islam. Wonderful doubt. The evidentiary miracle that the Muslims provided, that is, you know, by the time Jesus came along, the Jews thought, what, prophets are over, that era is over. Well, by the time Muhammad comes along, even the Christians are saying, prophets are over. So how are you going to prove that this is a prophet? Well, Deuteronomy says real prophets come with evidentiary miracles. And the miracle here is the Quran, the beauty of the Quran. So you have these Muslim Muslims of the Middle Ages all around the south of the Mediterranean Sea making fun of the Quran in this sort of wonderfully playful. You can see they feel very supported. They feel very safe, and they're attacking the core evidentiary miracle of this religion. And the reason that they get away with it for so long is because the medicine tended to be taught alongside philosophy. It was the same texts. So the great doctors were also the great atheists. Mm-hmm. And so when you're a doctor who's famous for both ability and compassion, that's when you get these books, whole books of atheism surviving from these people because they were so beloved.
Do you, does your research lend you to believe that perhaps we are working towards an end of faith where religion will become obsolete, so to speak?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that I don't think religion is going to become obsolete, but I think theism might. So I think that religion came up with a couple of things which are profoundly important. Religion is the repository of human thinking about how to get in a certain kind of mood through physical behaviors. Mm-hmm. The praying, the ritual, the meetings, the community, the meditations. And that mood is still very precious to human beings, and it's a very real part of being human. And what I find is humanist religious communities getting together and maybe keeping some trace of the religious feeling, but basically saying all the right things, saying, you know, that the, you know, if you're going to pray for anything, pray for your own strength, because that's what you need. And the way that religion really helps people is in the fact of community, meditation, either thinking about nothing or thinking about really good texts. Marcus Aurelius's book is called Meditations, and so are many other of the great philosophical texts. So they're right in the title that here's something that you... If I tell you not to worry and explain to you, look, you know, you can worry a knot and it'll come undone, but most problems aren't knots. You just have to wait and see. Mm-hmm. You know, I can talk, and the both of us can feel better about worry while I'm saying it, but it goes away real fast. And so meeting once a week, or even on your own once a week, returning to texts, having some kind of ritual, I think that has a future. I'm not much of a joiner myself, so I find myself in these communities very much... encouraged by what they're doing for each other. But I certainly don't think everybody needs to join one, though I do think everybody should at least give it a try. Mm-hmm. Some sort of communal kind of way of thinking about the meaning of life.
You mentioned ritual, and I think that's a very important point because I think ritual gives people a very strong sense of satisfaction.
Well, you need it.
Yeah.
You need it. You're going to meet somebody in a bar, and a few years later, you're going to be flesh of their flesh. Mm. You're going to need a little something special. You're going to bring a human being into existence, and it's now on your back to raise this person, to not somehow make a mistake. That is a huge thing to do without the sense that the community is behind you, watching you, helping. And, perhaps the worst one, death. If you don't get to the funeral, you may never really believe that the person is gone. It's very hard to understand that somebody who was here in your life is gone. And so these rituals, I think, are profoundly necessary. And when I think most people in America do what I call drop by and lie religion. I don't look down on drop by and lie religions. People who don't believe, but who realize that for weddings and births and funerals, that's where everybody goes and does the thing. And mm-hmm. So they go and do the thing because they know, look, if I go down to the town hall and just do it, it might not feel as real. Mm-hmm. They need the thing to feel real, and you need community, and you do need a kind of history of saying this is a real huge thing. Otherwise, it just, these things don't work. So I think what would be so much better is if people put a little bit of effort into finding communities where they don't say things they don't believe. I mean, you go for the most important moments in your life into a place marked as sacred and say things you don't believe. It's kind of heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. You should in that moment be able to say, you know, not that God has brought us together, but we have brought ourselves together and this community is surrounding us. And then still, light the candles. Do whatever the thing is that your people do to make you feel married, because that's a hell of a thing to bite off if you're really on your own. And you're not on your own. And that's what's wonderful. And these rituals help you to see that and help you to feel like you've really gone through these experiences that are otherwise sometimes, you know, you can end up saying, you know, I don't feel different. Well, there's a way of doing that.
Right.
Yeah. I think Americans are going to have to start changing the doctrines that get said in these sacred places so they can continue to use them. Also, they're beautiful buildings and you get a tax break.
Yeah.
You know, so it's interesting to think about what we could do without purging it of everything, but with purging it of real supernaturalism, because that's a problem.
Okay. Well, perhaps to close out, yeah. you are a celebrated poet. Could you tell us about some ways to advance free-thinking skepticism through art, through creative enterprise?
Yeah, sure. I love that question. Well, I think for one thing that any real study of poetry that has their eyes open to the question will find that the most of the great poets in the English language, certainly, were skeptics, if not atheists.
Mm-hmm.
You can find the ones that at least seem really wrapped up with talking about God, people like Hopkins or Gerald Manley Hopkins or John Donne. Even there, even with John Donne, he's questioning it, but he's really deeply in it. But you look at somebody like Percy Shelley. Shelley was kicked out of Oxford for writing The Necessity of Atheism. Big, loudmouth atheist. That's early 1800s. His Ozymandias has continued to inspire people in a kind of, you know, it's a kind of negative picture. It's kind of a sad picture, but it's also a wake-up, fame is fleeting, and life is what we have here kind of image. Keats is someone who, in his juvenilia, we find a couple of angels here and there, but as soon as he, you know, by the time he becomes a great poet, you do not see any supernaturalism. When he says, when, you know, the poem, "When I have fears that I may cease to be," you know, the next line is before his pen can get down his teeming brain, he's going to die. He knows it. His brother's already been coughing blood into a hanky, and he died, and now he's Keats himself is now coughing blood into a hanky. He knows what's going to happen. And so what does he do when he has fears that he may cease to be? He goes down to the ocean, and he looks at the ocean till fame and love, till to nothingness do sink.
Hmm.
He does a very human, reasonable thing to do, to go and show yourself that the world is very big and you're a part of it, and you can sort of let go of your ambitions and just try to roll with that. Yeats is another one. He struggles with spiritualism his whole life. He has some wacky ideas, but his basic notion is that the Christianity of his childhood is all wrong. He says very clearly in several places, just cannot believe in an afterlife, cannot believe in God. And he's got these great poems that speak to that. Emily Dickinson also, she speaks of God in an afterlife, but for the most part, you know, she's got this one little poem, "Faith is a fine invention when gentlemen can see, but microscopes are prudent in an emergency." She's really, you know, she's a real cat and mouse game, but she's wise, and she sees some people that she loves very much in her life die young deaths, and she speaks about the pain, but she certainly does not go to God for that. So that the poetic record, the absolute best of our poets are right there with us. And throughout history, that's been much more evident. Right now, we're living in a period where, quite frankly, the Cold War did it. In the beginning of the 20th century, it was in all of North America, there were out loud skeptics. Thomas Edison tells the New York Times, like 1913, that there is no God, there is no afterlife. The Times, you know, front page, and it all, you know, he has to write some apology letters, but he doesn't even write very good ones. They're hilariously, you know, unrepentant. I think that I tried to put a lot of the humanistic arguments in Doubt a History, and so that in some ways is the best place that I can, because, you know, in some ways that book is my notes. You know, it's what I wanted to remember from everything I studied. I certainly found a lot more doubt, a lot more irreligion and questioning than I ever expected.
Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for talking with us on Radio Free Thinker, and enjoy the rest of town.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So that was a great interview with Jennifer Michael Hecht, and thanks, Jennifer, for doing that. And I encourage everybody out there to go out and pick up Doubt, A History. It is a fantastic read on the history of atheism.
That was the first in a series of interviews you did at TAM. What's some of the other ones that are coming up on?
Well, just to throw it out there, we have some guy named Michael Shermer. I don't know if you guys have heard of him. We have paranormal investigator Joe Nickel. We have the cast of The Reality Check with some guy that used to be on this show, apparently. Don't remember who he is. And we have more, so stay tuned for that in the coming weeks. But Don, you a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the G20 goings-ons in
Toronto.
It's sort
of a priming of the well.
So some interesting ideas have surfaced, some conspiracy theories, some ideas. Enlighten us. What's going on?
Well, a lot of people have been sitting there saying sort of like, what went wrong with the G20 in Toronto? There's been a lot of controversy on it. The events in Toronto saw the largest mass arrest, over 1,000 people, in the history of this country. Even the FLQ crisis, which imposed martial law in the 70s, had less than 500 people arrested. So, you know, the idea here is, you know, are we taking our rights and freedoms for granted, or is this just like some media stunt where violence is put as a big flashy thing? There's several issues involved here at the meeting. You know, a lot of global leaders were there. The first issue, of course, is cost. Everyone's talking about the cost. The G20 and G8 cost over $1 billion for a 3-day event.
How much did they spend on security?
Well, actually, the billion is the security.
Oh.
And that included, as part of the package, a fence enclosure that cost only $10 million.
Only?
Although, to be fair, it was a 10-kilometer fence. It was a 10-kilometer fence. They also apparently got some new equipment. They got the sound cannons, which apparently we were only renting here in Vancouver, but I guess they bought them. Secondhand, I wonder. And, of course, people hours. I'm politically correct, right? You don't say man hours anymore. It's people hours. Is this a lot of money? Is it a lot of money to spend $10 billion? So I thought I'd go back and I'd take a look at, you know, other things. For example, the Olympics here. The Olympics, as everyone knows, security cost a little over $1 billion for that. Now, granted, that was over a 26-day event. And there's actually been a history of terrorist attacks during the Olympics. People may or may not remember, but several people died in Munich and there was Atlanta bombing.
So what you're saying is we spent less on security here in the Olympics for a longer event than they did in Toronto for a shorter event.
Yes. And, of course, you know, someone say, well, these were heads of state. Well, at the Olympics, there were at least 10 heads of state, plus 40 other people who were of noteworthy, you know, royalty, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention, you know, did you know there was, like, over 4,000 performers at the event?
I did not notice that.
I read that stat and I went, holy crap. And then, of course, you know, there are tens of thousands who were in the audience and over 1 billion people watching it. So, I mean, really, if you were going to do something for impact, what a prime event, right? But it worked out to be roughly $40 million a day they spent on that. Now, of course, you say, well, you know, apples and oranges, this wasn't the Olympics, this was a, you know, political thing, and there have been a number of protests that have gotten, shall we say, a little exuberant in the past, right?
Just a smidgen out of hand.
So I thought I'd look at previous G20s. The last one was in Pittsburgh. Now, of course, I figured, okay, this is the Americans, 9/11 scared, you know, they probably went nuts. Any guesses how much? Anyone?
$1 billion?
$5 billion.
Well, you know, that was so what I was thinking. $13 million.
$13 million?
$13 million.
That's like pocket change.
Now, and again, let's compare, you know, apples and apples. The London in 2009, they had an event, and the whole event, security at all, was $20 million. So, you know, that worked out to be roughly $15 million a day. It was a two-event day, right? You know, ours was three, so there was a little extra there. So, I mean, you compare that, $15 million a day compared to ours, and I worked it out to be roughly $350 million, assuming my math is correct. So, like, holy crap.
Where'd the money come from? Was this all?
What about, I mean, maybe as a possible explanation, could this be security inflation? Is the average cost of security rising to this, to explain this? And is it possible that we're paying for things like new sound cannons and, I mean, you know, like every year Apple comes up with a brand new iPhone, iPad, thing, and they're always like $700. So, I mean, is security coming up with like really cool gadgets that we're paying
for? The new version of security.
Like, is Inspector Gadget doing this? Like, what's going on here?
Well, you know, I'm trying to quickly do my math here, but these were events that held last year. So, with what, $15 million to $350 million, that's a
pretty huge increase.
percent increase, yeah. So no, I don't think it was that. In fact, there's this thing called the Miami model, which we'll probably talk about a little later. And one of the aspects of this, it's like they had a G20 or G8. I think it was the Free Trade Zone for the Americas meeting in Miami. And they kind of had this tactic, this plan of how they should handle, you know, the media, how they should do whatever. And one of the big things they said, you need to spend a lot of money, consider it to be like a cash cow, your Christmas tree. And, I mean, I guess Pittsburgh thought $13 million was a pretty good Christmas, but they weren't thinking Donald Trump dreams, I guess, or something, right? Hmm.
Well, I guess the question here is, so they spent a lot of money on security for G20. Was it worth it?
Well, a lot of that money was spent on people, personnel. A lot of the money actually didn't go to hardware. It actually went to salaries. So you're right. So the next issue was what are the roles of the security forces, right? As Rob is trying to point at, you know.
Gee, thanks.
That guy over there is saying.
One of the main reasons why was to protect the delegates from terrorists and people from quote-unquote black bloc anarchist thugs.
Now, those are the guys that were wearing all black and smashing up windows and stuff. You saw it all on TV, right? And they were at the Olympics, too, right?
Yep. And I mean, you know, first of all, like to protect the delegates, they had the 10-kilometer fence. The other part was supposed to be handled by, and again, depending on where your sources are, anywhere from 10 to 20,000 state officers, right? So, you know, and at best, there may have been in the largest, there may have been 10,000 protesters, but most of the protests were in hundreds, right? So there was a huge discrepancy between number of people and that. But if we go on to the idea that if they were just there to protect the people, you know, the delegates, they could have put one person along their fence every 4 meters, made sure no one could have got through. Because one of the things they said, well, we have to have this rapid response force, we can go anywhere we want, we need... They said crowd control, and there was a few other things that had come up that I'm going to mention a little bit later. The real big reason for all the people, of course, is to protect Toronto. They said, well, you know, there's going to be all this rioting, the black bloc, they're just going to destroy everything. And anyone who watched the events saw that the only thing the police didn't do was go after the black bloc when they were going through the streets smashing windows. I mean, they were there. There were a number of them. Most accounts told them about 100 people were there. But it was almost as though they were kind of ignoring them. Now, one of the things about this Miami model that I was mentioning before is you have to set the stage. And one of the things that they wanted to set the stage with, and again, this is something that people write us, say, hey, I think you're going off the rails here, is the idea that before the event, first of all, you have to create the environment. The press releases, there were a lot of press releases by the security forces that were saying, we're really worried about this event coming up. We've spent a lot. We think we're ready for it. But there's going to be violence. We have all these black bloc terrorists coming out. And if you looked at a lot of the things, and in fact, it was hilarious. I was watching the CBC News, and they had Huntsville, which is where the G8 was. It's just a little north of Toronto. And the townspeople were kind of disappointed. And, you know, that was the news article of the day, because they were so let up that there was going to be these huge protests, right? And they were boarding up windows, but they were also hoping they were going to make a big killing on local protesters buying ice cream or whatever, right? And they were so disappointed that all these people. And one of the reasons why, because again, there was this big hype. You know, there was this expectation.
So part of the strategy of the Miami model that people say that the G20 might have used was to create the environment in which protests might actually happen.
Anyone who does a lot of political science, like I do, and if you do debating, and we know this as skeptics or whatever, is providing a context for debate. If you can define the context of a debate, quite often you can kind of squirrel where the debate is gonna go in it. And that was one of them. Another interesting thing, and again, it was one of those things, I was listening to one of my podcasts, and I was listening to the news sort of at the same time, because being schizophrenic, you get to do more than one thing at a time. And on the podcast was this woman who was giving a lecture about the Miami model, and she says, one of the things that's important that they do, and they don't officially mention this, but it's happened so many times, is they have a big flashy, they find a huge cache of weapons, and they make a big deal about, ooh, this cache of weapons.
I remember seeing that. They found this huge, they like batons and clubs and stuff, and there was even a crossbow and like a big sword that they found.
Well, the one I saw, actually I don't remember seeing that one, but the one I saw was they stopped this guy's car. This was before the G20 had hit Toronto. It was a few days before even the GA. They stopped this guy's car. He had in his car a bunch of fuel. And you go, oh, fuel. He had an axe. He had a chainsaw. And he had a crossbow. And the guy was going camping. Right? So, I mean, yes, it was a little weird.
And the one that I heard about where they were showing this big table full of weapons that they'd taken, and the most impressive thing on it was like this sword and crossbow, I think. Turns out they had taken off some guy who wasn't a protester. He was on his way to LARPing, live-action role-playing, somewhere in Ontario. And they took away his LARPing weapons.
He's not a terrorist, he's just a nerd.
Yeah.
But actually, I think you saw one of the things I saw is that they had, in Toronto, in one of the big malls, the police had a big display of all the weapons that they had confiscated during this, right, a representative, right? And like you say, on there was a sword, there was a crossbow.
Yeah, that was it.
Right? And the reporter says, so you found all this, you know, all this at the thing. And the officer says, oh, yes. Well, except for the crossbow and the sword. You go, what? Yeah. So the only thing you found that were weapons were sticks and rocks. And maybe those weren't weapons, because if you walk down the street, you know what you can see sometimes? Sticks and rocks, right? In fact, actually, coincidentally, we happen to have someone come into our studio here from... who was in the University of Toronto and was arrested and was actually charged with conspiracy because he was sleeping with people who were wearing black. And, of course, the...
Sleeping in a gymnasium with a bunch of francophones, as I remember him saying.
Okay,
we might actually get him on the show. If you're listening, get in touch with us.
Yeah. Well, you know, and they said weapons of opportunity. And so what's a weapon of opportunity? Well, it's normal things that could be used of a weapon if you're in the right mind. So chairs are weapons of
anything
opportunity.
Can be used as a weapon of
exactly.
opportunity.
So, you know, and just this whole fragility.
So we have the press releases. We have the big weapons caches. What else is going on here that is set up for show? One thing that I've actually seen, there's this thing that's been going around for the past couple of weeks. A guy named Terry Burrows published this thing on globalresearch.ca, basically saying that the Toronto G20 protest riots were a fraud, that the Black Bloc protesters were actually police in disguise inciting violence to once again justify the amount of money spent on security at the G20 conference in the sort of Miami model.
Does he actually provide any evidence, or is he just pulling things out of his butt?
He provides evidence in that he has video that people took while they were there, YouTube photos that the Globe and Mail took, and he identifies that a bunch of the Black Bloc protesters that were doing some of the nastier stuff, like smashing in the windows of police cars and setting them on fire and things like that, were wearing the same regulation issue boots as the police officers. And now this is a little...
That's pretty lame.
This is a little iffy, but what I thought was interesting was he said this has happened before in Montreal in 2007 at the Montebello protests, where there were these three protesters, these Black Bloc protesters, that were wearing the exact same shoes as the cops there, and they were inciting riot. And the other protesters were actually telling them, stop it, you're police, you know, in disguise, take off your masks. The organizer of the protest, there's this big, great shot of him, like, facing these three guys wearing little bandanas over their faces and telling them to put down the rock. And what's really interesting is that it was true. There's a CBC article I found. I decided to fact check this because I was like, okay, this guy sounds like a conspiracy theorist, and he's saying that, like, look at their shoes, they're the same. I'm like, they have the same little yellow dot on the bottom. I'm like, well, okay. Yeah, no, I'm going to fact check. Found a CBC news article dated 2007, and the headline was, three Quebecois police officers admit to being in disguise as protesters at this protest, which is pretty huge. However, I read further in the article, and they do not admit to inciting any violence. They say that they were there undercover to make sure that the protesters didn't get violent. Now, it's a bit of a case of he said, she said here, but I think it's interesting that there is precedent for police being undercover as protesters.
Well, you know, and one of the other things that, again, anyone who looks at the videos, right, and not YouTube videos, this is like CBC, CTV News, is when you see at least one of the police cars when it's burned, when being burnt up, you can see, like, less than a block away. I think it's like a block and a half of the side block. So, you know, you see the police in their riot gear all lined up.
And they're standing there watching them set the car on fire.
Set it on fire and actually ignoring it. Because, I mean, one of the things of police in anything is to try and protect people. A car on fire is an explosive hazard, especially a police car, because you could hear every so often pops going off, which I'm going to assume was perhaps ammunition in the vehicle, because again, you'd think cop cars would have some form of ammunition going off on it, right? And yet they stood back, they waited until you had about an hour of video and the car was pretty much just toasted trash. Then they come and they charge the scene, right? Well, why didn't they even try before, right? I mean, maybe they were worried there was going to be pushback, sure, but don't they have a moral responsibility? And I think where this also goes, and this is where we need to do the next step of work, is sometimes things that appear like a conspiracy theory are actual conspiracies. Maybe not overt, maybe not dark men in black. Sometimes they are. Where we really need to do is we need to have a good investigation of this. We need to have a proper Crown Committee that...
Yeah, someone looking into it, and not just the police investigating themselves, because when that's happened in the past, they usually find, well, there was no wrongdoing. I mean, an independent investigation. I mean, my opinion here is that maybe there were cops undercover at the G20 protests, but they probably weren't there to incite violence to justify the massive cost of the security. They're probably there to make sure that there wasn't any violence on the behalf of the Black Bloc. And then things come to a head. People start, you know, getting up into each other's faces. There's this video that was going around of this girl blowing bubbles. And there's a cop there saying, if any one of those bubbles touches me, that's assault. And what happens? One of the bubbles touches him, and they take the girl away. She was arrested. So it's high tension, people going us and them. Maybe some of them are in disguise, but they're not actually there to incite violence. Someone thinks they are, and things blow up.
Yeah, I mean, from a strict point of view of determining sort of like from the police best interest, if they are undercover, if that got out that they were in fact inciting violence, that is a huge problem. I mean, like, people get fired, they could get jail time, who knows exactly what could happen. So I think we need to be critical, but at the same time, we should, you know, examine all the evidence, but at the same time, we should go, okay, well, you know, Occam's razor, let's take a step back and look at this. You know, it's not in their best interest to get caught breaking windows or hurting people.
Now, as the resident communist here, I would not want to incite anyone to revolution. but I think what we have here, again, this is something to keep a critical eye, to keep a skeptical view, say, okay, there's smoke, doesn't mean there's fire. And in fact, actually, I'm sure people in our audience will have opinions one way or the other about this. And we'd really, really like to hear from you. So please send us your email, send us your comments. What do you think happened? Do you think it's all in our head? At radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Right, and you can comment on our blog at www.radioforthinker.com. We're right out of time, so let's quickly go to our skeptical highlights. The biggest highlight that I think we all should be aware of is that on July 30th, one P.Z. Myers will be here in Vancouver to give a talk entitled Atheism in the Scientific Battleground. And you can check out www.cficanada/Vancouver for all the information and how to get tickets. So please do that.
I've only got two, and these, of course, are outdated because it takes me a long time to read a book, and this is a paper book. A book you should read is called Climate Wars by Gwynne Dwyer, and another book by Matt Herding, I'm screwing up his name. It's called The Truth About Canada. Both of those really good books to check out.
And if you're listening live, there is a talk going on at the Railway Club tonight, starting at 6:30, I believe. It's sponsored by Café Scientifique. It's Nando de Freitas, a professor here at UBC, giving a talk on machine learning and what it means for cognition. Highly recommended.
All right, well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying have a good evening.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa!